minutes, I think. 3 hours in which we will deal into all of such things as reincarnation, the extraterrestrial intelligence, direct communication from sources greater than your own. And we'll deal with it from a very, very unusual source. As I was looking over the subject matter to be covered by our guest, who is not yet with us, he had a lecture appointment tonight, so he'll be a few minutes late. It was it looked like a voyage into the realm of open mind, and I knew that I had to have this man on the show, and I'll introduce him to you when he does arrive. We will be talking about the Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, and there is a lot in there that I didn't know was there. And there's a lot about the Kabbalah that very few people know. And we have one of the world's greatest or leading foremost authorities on the Kabbalah with us, Dr. Philip Berg. And while we're waiting for Dr. Berg to get here, however, I certainly will entertain any questions that you may have about any of the open mind material that may be on your mind until he does arrive. Let me give the telephone numbers in Los Angeles, 520-TALK. All numbers end in TALK, T-A-L-K. San Fernando Valley, your number is 990. In Orange County, 750. In Burbank, Glendale, and Pasadena, 244. In the San Gabriel Valley, we're 448. Down in the South Bay area, your number is 679. In Long Beach, San Pedro, Paramount, Compton, Lakewood, that area, your number is 639. So we have an open forum until Dr. Berg gets here about any and everything. I do want to take this moment to tell you how gratified I am that so many of you have written to me and expressing an interest in going with us to London. The London trip for the Open Mind listeners via the KABC Travel Club will take place in the last week of October. I believe it's the 23rd that we will board an airplane and go to London. And we will be there for a week. And what a time that we're going to have in London. They have worked out a marvelous schedule for us. We'll be staying, I believe it is, at the Waldorf Hotel. We will go, of course, to see London. We'll see Buckingham Palace. We'll see those places. We will visit a number of places that are well known for having spiritual manifestations there, or ghosts, if you want to call them, the haunted houses. We will go up one day, spend the day at Stonehenge and see Stonehenge, going over to Bath and see that. We will end up our week in England on the Royal Vessel Barracuda that will be steaming up and down the Thames River right under the Tower of London and London Bridge, and we will be having a Halloween night of it with a kind of a dress-up Halloween party and dinner cocktail party there on the River Thames on Halloween night, and then it'll be back. It'll take a week, and through the auspices of the KABC Travel Club, I think you'll find it extremely reasonable. We have three lectures along the way, one of them by Lord Clancarney of the House of Lords. He will fill us in on the House of Lords' own investigation into the phenomena of the unidentified flying object. And Lord Kilcowney certainly understands and knows that they are a reality, and he'll be glad to share all of that with you. We'll have lectures from one of the leading experts in England on this matter of what you might want to call ghosts. But those things have been seen, and they've been proven, and they've been photographed, and some of the people are just hanging around some of these places. We're even going to have banquets in some two or three of the great banquet halls of the castles that are in and around near London. And, of course, all of those castles have their own ghosts that occupy them, and maybe we'll get a chance to see those. So I'm looking forward to taking as many of you with me who can possibly go. It's a great way to see London, the last week of October. And if you're interested, just write me a letter here, Bill Jenkins, KABC Radio, 3321 South La Cienega Boulevard, Los Angeles, 90016, and just write London Trip on it. And I will scoot all of those cards and letters to Chucky Travel, who is the head of the Travel Club, Travel Consultants of America out in Burbank, and they'll get back to you with all of the information. Dr. Patrick Flanagan is going to go with us, so I know that you'll probably be wanting to talk to Patrick and Gail, and, oh, a lot of surprises. And the more that goes, the better we are. Okay, let's go to our phone while we're waiting for Dr. Berg to get here. We're talking to Hugh. Hugh, welcome aboard.
Hi, Bill. I must admit that I'm a little glad that your guest didn't show up on time this evening, because it gives me a chance to bring up something from last week's show and something that was in the news this week.
Okay.
Did you see the Associated Press release and the CBS coverage of the noises in San Francisco Bay that are being heard in Sausalito?
I've heard about the noises. They're also being heard in the Puget Sound.
In Puget Sound, which is exactly 2 degrees longitude from a straight line up from San Francisco Bay.
Those seem to be summertime nocturnal noises, and they've been returning faithfully for the last 11 years.
Right, and the Navy is totally at a loss as to what they might be, and they're heard at exactly the same time in Puget Sound and San Francisco Bay. Interesting, huh?
Well, it leads you to believe that it's not something that's drumming away in San Francisco Bay.
Right.
That certainly it would seem that some energy is being pumped into that area for reasons unknown. Why it's picking just the summertime to do it is hard to say.
And we get a lot of attention focused on that noise, and it seems to be a little worse right now than it ever has been. And suddenly we've got these horrendous rainstorms and thunderstorms in the Cheyenne area.
Strange, isn't it?
Weird. Thank you, Bill.
All right. Thank you, Hugh, for bringing that to attention. That was very perceptive of you. We're certainly... I know some of the people that were involved in a lot of the research and data that we used in last week's show are looking at the sounds at Sausalito and Puget Bay to see if it's a Puget Sound to see if there's any kind of connection, if they're connected with woodpecker signals of all, any of those things. So we'll try to find out.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, you. Now we have Jerry. Jerry, welcome aboard.
Hi, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
I really loved the show last week, and I was really glad that you had it. And there was something that you talked about on the show last week that reminded me about the propulsion system in the Enterprise,
mm-hmm.
The Starship. One thing that, if I remember right, they used a warping system there. They warped space, and that was the thing that propelled the Enterprise through space. And I'm wondering if anyone has thought of, like, I wonder if the Russians are using this for, like, a propulsion device.
I have no idea what the Russians are using anything for, except usually it's to no good,
mm-hmm.
as far as, you know, from our perspective or our vantage point.
Mm-hmm.
The propulsion device of the that marvelous spaceship Enterprise, you understand, is a product of Gene Roddenberry's science fiction
mm-hmm.
mind, which
mm-hmm.
is a very, very good one, by the way, and deep-reaching, and certainly was aware of some science that was around that said we may be doing something like that in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Scalar interferometry as a form of propulsion system, it certainly has all of the attributes necessary to the science, although it's relatively new, to be the propulsion system of the future, and even has the capability of allowing you to move into space without having to go through escape velocity. Anything?
Yeah, it seems like it would be the ideal way of avoiding the problems of trying to stay with or being limited by the speed of light, because if you warp state, it seemed like you would be able to control, you know, the time dilation effect that way, and that way you would never... You probably would have the effect of never really moving anywhere. The space itself may move.
You warp space-time, or bend
space-time, right.
As it said.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to see, certainly we are seeing some laboratory work where this is being done now. It's no longer the figment of the physicist's imagination. It does happen.
Uh-huh.
And it happens on a very local basis, as well as one way out there in space in the far distance from it. It's a local phenomenon as well as a distant one, which certainly changes the view that you have to take of physics these days.
Uh-huh. It seems like it would be the ideal, you know, propulsion system, because if you can get energy from space itself, then, you know, you wouldn't necessarily be limited by the amount of power that you would need.
Now, the whole world, all of the universe, it seems, of course, not having been to all of the universe, but we could just say it seems, it floats in a sea of energy, and you might as well use it.
Yeah, I really love the show, and all I can say is thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Jerry, for your interest and for calling in.
Okay. Goodbye.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Saturday night. It's Open Mind. We have an open forum going with you right now until our guest, Dr. Philip Berg, gets here, which will be a fascinating evening as we look into the mystical world of the Jewish Kabbalah. But that's Open Mind country if I ever saw it, from what I've been able to read so far of his works. I'll be right back. We're talking about the open mind, in fact, as I get into it. Our guest finally arrived. Welcome to Open Mind, Dr. Philip Berg. You're with our people. I mean, I start reading books like The Kabbalah Connection, and we're talking about reincarnation. We're talking about extraterrestrial intelligence. We're talking about a lot of things that are sort of germane and basic to what we do here on the open. I didn't know that we were Jewish. What is the Kabbalah?
Well, first, let me just extend a thank you, Bill, for being on your program. I've heard a great deal of the efforts that you and so many throughout the world are trying to present a new redirection, excuse me, in our thinking, opening up our minds, as I'd like to refer to as. The Kabbalah is, I think you've kind of stated it far better than I can, and that is to create a greater awareness of not only the cosmos, not only of extraterrestrial intelligence, but what I'm afraid of is that we have very little knowledge of our own selves. We're kind of closed. And the Kabbalah, in its presentation and redirecting our way of perception of things around us, I think will permit us to see something far and above the five senses, what we call the metaphysical.
Mm-hmm.
It's right here. It's right around us. Unfortunately, we don't see it.
Now, the Kabbalah has been around for a long, long time, hasn't it?
It's been around since the first astrologer, from a Kabbalistic point of view, and that was Abraham the Patriarch some 3,800 years ago.
Has it played an important role or part in the development of, say, the Jewish religion and the Jewish nation? Or is it something that is aside, more or less like an oral history, rather than the actual written word and the laws and the commandments upon which ritual and ceremony and rote seem to be built?
Well, shall I say, unfortunately, you kind of put it correctly. Most religions have encouraged its congregants or people involved in whatever religion they might be to conduct most of their ritual as rote. From a Kabbalistic point of view, that is the furthest from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Religion as such, in my own humble opinion, has failed to some extent. We're always looking for peace on earth and goodwill towards men. And somehow the stress on morality and precepts, commandments, just doesn't seem to kind of do the job. We're still in the same old conflict since Abel and Cain.
Have we really made much progress since Abel and Cain is the question, I guess, that arises, and where I figure that progress would be made, and that is the true evolvement of the soul or the spirit. And we've tried many things. Certainly in man's history, the Jewish religion has been very, very important. Certainly on... from the descendants of Adam and on down, that part of the world. And then came the Christian religion beyond that, and there is a connection between the two. But we still see that man's inhumanity to man simply hasn't changed too much since the very earliest days. Where are we going wrong?
Well, you've already established that we must be doing something wrong. So, from a Kabbalistic point of view, we're just not observing the Old Testament, which is the origin of all religions. And I think we're kind of looking into the Bible as a document to be understood on a very superficial level. And from a Kabbalistic point of view, the Bible is nothing more than a cosmic code. And the Kabbalah is its deciphering.
Mm-hmm. Who wrote the Kabbalah?
The Kabbalah, the first book on Kabbalah, was written by Abraham the Patriarch, and which is a very abstruse document. However, it's the implications concerning astrological influence is so enormous and profound, and yet this document has been hidden and concealed for whatever reasons for some 3,800 years. And as head of Diener, the research center of Kabbalah, this is our primary thrust, to bring to all peoples of the world an awareness of what's really going on out there, rather than the preconceived notions that have brought us nowhere.
Well, you say that the Kabbalah has been hidden for all of these years. Was it stuck away in a cave and found by a young shepherd boy? Or has it been around but was maintained a sort of a mystic secret air to it because the time wasn't right for this new information, which is really old information, to get into the general wellspring of life? Or was it being held down because of political forces within a religious group, which have been known to have those?
Well, I guess we prefer to remain non-political, and nevertheless, I think the statement you made concerning the time wasn't right is probably more closer to the truth. And in fact, the author of the Zohar, which is the principal text for the understanding of Kabbalah, makes it very clear to us that peoples of all religions in the age of Aquarius are going to receive this knowledge. The knowledge that will ultimately bring the feeling of love thy neighbor.
The real feeling of it.
That's right.
When did the... Is it Kabbalah? Is that the way you pronounce it?
That's correct.
I've been mispronounced. From Texas. What am I supposed to say? Kabbalah? When did this start surfacing then among the people? And has it been surfacing just among the Jewish community, or has it been worldwide?
Well, one of the basic principles of Kabbalah is the teaching of the three-column system, the triad. The Star of David represents two triads, one on an upper level and extraterrestrial and celestial, and the lower triad is the terrestrial level. And I don't know where the Trinity came from, but if there's anything that is close to the triad, you've got it right there too. So it's been around a long, long time. However, the time wasn't right.
Its influence then, say in the last 5,000 years, 4,000 years, has not been that great then in, for instance, the religious thinking within the Jewish community, certainly within the Christian community.
It's been true for both religions.
Mm-hmm.
While there is an acknowledgement of its existence and its validity and credibility, I guess we just weren't ready.
Just weren't ready for it. But you can pretty well establish that part of its authorship belonged to Abraham? Or who were some of the other writers of the Kabbalah? Kabbalah.
Well, you might be a Texan, but I'm going to have to tell you, Bill, but in the prior incarnation, you were just what you said you were. Okay. We then... some 2,000 years ago, when the world met its first upheaval, a chaotic upheaval, disorder in the universe, both on a celestial and terrestrial level, and that was during the time of the destruction of the Holy Temple, which provided nourishment for all peoples of the world. An individual whose name was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son, hidden in the cave 13 years, so as to negate the corporeal influence of what we call the desire to receive for oneself alone, so as to achieve an elevation where they would come to the realization that there is only one thing that this world is going to have to learn, and learn real quick, and that is the art of sharing. Sharing for the sake of sharing, rather than for the sake of receiving. And there the basic text for Kabbalah came into existence, revealed by Moses himself and Elijah the prophet, our first two space astronauts. For those of you familiar with the Old Testament, it's very clear that space vehicles were known at that time. And so if we're getting any messages from out there, well, thank you, Elijah. But I hope you're coming a little loud and strong than you are at the present time.
Turn it up a little bit. Yes, the Bible, as we read it now, we've gone into that on many occasions here on this program, is quite replete with descriptions of extraterrestrials and their craft, particularly the Old Testament, particularly Genesis. It's quite a wonder whenever you start getting down into the etymology of those words. And I see that in the writings that you have done in these marvelous books of yours, the Kabbalah Connection, the Wheels of the Soul, and then you explain the Kabbalah for the layman, there is a connection in what you're teaching in these books and what we have learned from a lot of other different sources, which I find quite fascinating.
It's all coming together today.
Mm-hmm.
The interest, the fact that you have, and I've been told, a very popular program, there is a change. A great number of people.
I think so, and the change is there. The 5 years, 10 years ago, the show wouldn't have happened. In fact, 5-6 years ago when we started, we thought we had 2 chances, slim and none. But it has done very well because of the material. But it is very encouraging for me to sit here and see a rabbi or a clergy of any kind talk to me about astral projection, the astral body, reincarnation, extraterrestrial life and intelligence, and have that rooted in a religious belief. I find it fascinating, and I think you will tonight. On Open Mind, my guest is Dr. Philip S. Berg, and we'll be back in just a moment. The Kabbalah with Dr. Philip S. Berg, who is one of the world's foremost authorities on this ancient bit of teaching, which sounds so very, very modern. We talk about Atlantis, in fact, in there. Was there an Atlantis, Dr. Berg?
Well, if I was there or not, I kind of will pass that question. But from the description of the Zohar, the basic text of Kabbalah, seems to indicate that there is a nation living underwater presently that was witnessed by several of the students of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Now, that's what it says. That these people who are the people of Atlantis are those, that civilization, that most advanced civilization of the Tower of Babel. When we read in Genesis, they were going to build this 7,000-story structure. And we still haven't, I think, achieved anything more than maybe 110 stories. And without getting into the details of why these people were dispersed, but nevertheless, they wound up underwater. And how do these students even reach? You know, we think that it's only fish that can live underwater, but nevertheless, there is a civilization and there is an art on how people can live underwater. So that's where Atlantis is presently.
In the Atlantic?
In the Atlantic.
The Bermuda Triangle, is that a part of it?
I kind of believe it is. I can't say for sure just where it is in the Atlantic, and since the Bermuda Triangle seems to have this this unnatural or paranormal phenomena, I would kind of myself connect Atlantis with the Bermuda Triangle.
So why would a civilization be existing underwater like that on a planet such as this? They like it better there?
No, but if we get into the energy intelligence of water, and that's one of the things we're trying to establish, that when we relate to water or relate to any inanimate object from a Kabbalistic point of view, the atom and all structure, all molecular structure, has an energy intelligence, a desire of one kind or another. Now, water has a desire, an energy, intelligence of sharing. That's why it seeks its own level. Mm-hmm. It goes against gravity. And inasmuch as these people were involved with a negative activity of the desire to receive for oneself alone, that's really what the Tower of Babel is all about. Greed, corruption, for oneself alone. They were immersed within the energy intelligence of water, which is the desire to share. And so convert these people from their desire to receive for oneself alone to an activity of sharing, which is principally the teachings of the Kabbalah for all mankind. That's got to come one day or another.
Mm-hmm.
And so we find these people within the water underneath.
Sharing the underwater life.
That's right. Getting accustomed to sharing.
And doing some strange things to some of the people who live above the water and get in their areas from time to time. Dean, you speak very strongly about the reality of reincarnation in your books as a part of the Kabbalic teaching. How did that great feeling of the men of philosophy who certainly were given information that was far beyond their conscious ability to have it, who wrote those great books of the Bible that we accept and this, how did reincarnation get out of the mainstream of thinking, both in the Jewish and in the Christian way of life? Wasn't always that way, I don't think.
Oh, by all means. But if I might, Bill, if I can have my wife Karen feel that question, she loves that one. And,
all right, Karen, get right on. Let me turn you on over there.
Hi. First of all, I don't believe that it is out of the mainstream. I think it perhaps is out of the main field of knowledge for most people. And therefore, as in any religious practice, they don't want to accept or acknowledge something that might cause them to differ, okay,
in their way of thinking. As far as to see reincarnation as an existing principle, 600,000 people left Egypt and went into the desert. And there was war between themselves. And there was many, many different things. People died and were born again. However, the end result was that 600,000 people entered the land of Israel. 24,000 people were killed during an episode in the Bible. 2,000 years at the time of the destruction of the temple, 24,000 people were destroyed in a plague, very much like the plague that killed them in the Bible. What I'm saying is that reincarnation as a process is a process to all of us, and the reason that a lot of the religious sects refuse to accept it as an existing truth is simply because they can't explain it.
I sometimes feel that one of the reasons I don't want to accept it is because that then gives you a reason to look at something with greater authority than the authority of the structured religious organization.
I think religion has a problem that they're going to have to face up to, and that is the Decalogue. We read in the third commandment where God will visit the sins of the forefathers upon the children and grandchildren. And every thinking individual is going to ask one basic question. Why am I responsible for the sins of my fathers or forefathers? And many have considered that to be an unfair doctrine within the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. And so this great sage, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who obviously wasn't inclined to restrict some of the comments he made, and said that that would be unfair, and we could not understand the Ten Commandments as including that kind of a doctrine. And therefore he goes on to interpret that we are not discussing the sins of the forefathers. We are considering our own sins. In other words, in a prior incarnation, that was what I did wrong. And when someone is born maimed, blind,
He's paying not for the sins of his forefathers or a prior generation. He is paying for his own sins when he himself, in a prior incarnation, committed those offenses, and the law of cause and effect applies both on a metaphysical and a physical level. And there we have the total doctrine of reincarnation. And how this misinformation or corruption ever came about is really even beyond me.
It certainly has come about. There are some fascinating success stories to be told of people who have all kinds of physical ailments, who once they are find out their about their previous lives, which can be done, and find out what it was that they did.
Fundamentally, the unknown. How can we possibly succeed in treating so many of these unfortunate individuals, like schizophrenia and the like, when we could very well consider the aspect of what we call in Kabbalah the D-book, an exorcism which is so clearly spelled out in Kabbalah. Now, these were the most foremost sages of our times. Now, if I professed to start a new religion today, and this was my thinking, I'd agree. Maybe I'm looking for a new religion. But I have never quoted anything in that book that was not documented by some acceptable, credible sage so many thousands of years ago. And established religion, all religions, going to have to come and face up to that.
What kind of reaction are you getting now from the leaders of the different Jewish religions that there are now to these teachings and this insight? Curiosity, or do they look upon you as some sort of a maverick?
Well, fortunately, it's both. So we're having a great number of clergy of all religions, even from Kuwait, who have shown an interest. And while they still must conform to the principles of established religion, but the interest and the acceptability and credibility of reincarnation is growing amongst the clergy. More so than you, Bill, would even imagine.
Well, it would be kind of stunning to me to find the clergy too deeply involved in it, other than to try to poo-poo it and put it down for some reason or another.
Well, you can't poo, you know, you can't put it down when we're referring and we're kind of producing source references,
mm-hmm,
of people with credibility.
There is, as we look at these many, many cases that the regressionist will do with people, where they start speaking as if they were someone else, living in another time, in another place, and perhaps even another sex, speaking languages that they don't know how to speak in this lifetime, you hear that could be just a genetic memory that comes down, rather than a spiritual memory. How do you feel about that? What does the Kabbalah say?
Well, that is that's one of the hints and signs of a prior incarnation, when suddenly an individual can begin speaking a language that, let alone he never studied, but he didn't even visit the country of that particular language. And there he goes, rattles it right off as if this was his native-born land. There is no other explanation other than the fact that this individual lived there in a prior incarnation and has returned for no other reason than to correct a prior offense.
Or perhaps evolve further from where he was. Doesn't necessarily always have to be a correcting process, does it?
No, that's correct, Bill. You can return for the sake of sharing some energy with close ones or the foremost, one of the foremost Kabbalists living in Safed, the mystical city in Israel, Rabbi Oz Gloria, who claimed that the only reason for his return was to instruct his student, Rabbi Chaim Vital, in the knowledge of the Kabbalah, and they, and he himself was instrumental in producing our 17-volume work on Kabbalah, the most extensive work, which was just completed some 2 months ago. Unfortunately, it's still in Hebrew, but we're moving right ahead on translation.
We're all going to have to learn how to speak Hebrew.
Well, I don't know about you. I think you know Hebrew.
Dr. Philip S. Berg is my guest tonight. He is the author of The Kabbalah Connection, The Wheels of a Soul, Kabbalah for the Layman, one of the foremost authorities on this thing that is getting attention more and more around the world, the Kabbalah. And we will continue that in just a moment.
Questions for you. Two concepts that I'd like you to discuss. I'm very enthused that you're on the program tonight. In fact, I couldn't believe it when I heard you were going to be on. First, I'd like you to talk about the concept of Olam Haba and why you think so many young Jews aren't aware of this concept that we have the world to come, that there is a physical resurrection in Judaism, that there is something more than simple death and that that's it. I think among many young Jews, there is this misconception. I have a degree in Judaic Studies, a bachelor's, and I was always amazed in class how many people were shocked when we started discussing and mentioning words like resurrection, but I guess because they grew up in a Christian society, wherein that sort of concept is linked with Jesus and the Christians and Revelation, that sort of thing. And as you know, many Jews will shy away from things which they associate with Christianity, which they don't know happen to be very Jewish in origin. I'd like you to talk about that, and I'd also like you to talk about Hashem, about the names of God, and about how in Kabbalah some rabbis have talked about certain names of God, certain ways of putting together the names, and perhaps even using gematria, and being able to create something out of that by being able to capture that essence, that power of God, which happened in Bereshit. Can you talk about that?
Charles, can you? We're going to let him wait on that because I got so wrapped up in talking to him here that I forgot something I've got to do. So we'll be right back. I'll kind of break in on that for just a second before we can get into what's going to be a good answer to a long string of a question, if you don't mind. And we will do that right after the news. We are just going to have to take another pause right here and take a break. Get a cup of coffee and Rabbi Philip Berg will be back after the news and to answer Charles's questions and your questions, too, about the Kabbalah. The Kabbalah is, it's our kind of stuff. We get into astral travel here, to Atlantis, and certainly loving one another with an intensity that few people know how to do. It's going to be a good night, so you stay with it. I'm Bill Jenkins. Celebration 25. 6 minutes past 10 on a Saturday night. Welcome to hour two of Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins. We're talking about the Kabbalah connection. And to make that connection is Rabbi Philip S. Berg, who probably knows as much about the Kabbalah as anyone around. And we think that you will find it quite fascinating to become familiar with it yourself. Charles was on the line when we left about 10 minutes ago, Charles. Sorry about that. So we'll get back to your question, Charles. Promise you that Philip will answer. Do you want to touch it again? Because just so that he gets all the points.
Okay, well, I guess it was a bit thrown out the first time. What I'd like you to discuss, Rabbi, is the concept of Olam Haba and in connection with that, physical resurrection, and the concept of the names of God being used in connection with creation of actual visual, physical objects and or physical realities. That's what I'd like you to talk about.
Okay.
That's my question.
Right. I'm right on with your question, Charles. The concept of Olam Haba, for those who are unfamiliar with its Hebrew terminology, refers to the world to come. All religions speak of the world to come. And I guess some of us, many of us or most of us, may not have experienced the world to come, and so maybe it's some fantasy. But from a Kabbalistic point of view, the definition of Olam Haba is something entirely different. We're not talking about something that comes in the world hereafter. We're discussing that level of consciousness which unfortunately for most of us remains concealed, unseen, and untouchable. The world of metaphysics. That is the world of Olam Haba. The world of cosmic consciousness, where the past, present, and future all exist at the same time. You know, that only reminds me about what I read in some physics books about the footprint on the Santa Monica Beach. That will be made, we're observing it right now, but that's going to be made sometime tomorrow by some individual. And we see it right now before he's even gotten to the beach. That implies, from a Kabbalistic point of view, that there are two aspects. The world of the conscious, what I'd like to refer to as the world of the unreal world, because that involves the five senses, the limitation of five senses, which goes and brings us to a point of what I call the unreal reality. When we speak of the manifestation of Olam Haba, it is that area where suddenly we receive and achieve a pure awareness of things that heretofore had been somehow hidden, concealed. You know, it even reminds me of the most elementary example that I'd like to give when someone's about to tie a package and he's gotten together his string and paper and everything else. And when he's just about ready to tie the package, he can't find the string. And then he looks all over his place, his apartment, and he just can't find it. When he returns back to the place where the package is, lo and behold, the string was there all the time, but he didn't see it. And many of us kind of think we do see things, and we're a little confused. Another example I'd like to give is when sometimes we call our friends and say, you know, I met you at some boulevard, the intersection of two boulevards, and but I didn't have a chance to get over and talk to you. And your friend tells you, well, that was impossible. I wasn't in L.A. today. I was in Paris. And then we kind of shy it off and say, oh, well, it probably must have been someone who looked like you. And the answer is no. That was you there, because at that moment, your energy intelligence, the real you, which is not limited, the cosmic conscious level of you, that 90% possibly of you, that can travel faster than the speed of light, can bring you from Paris to Los Angeles in that split moment. And you were there, and I saw you. I saw you physically. We sometimes, refer to that phenomenon as teleportation. But teleportation is right there in the Bible, and I mentioned that in Wheels of a Soul. So Olam Haba is very real, right here, not in the hereafter.
Rabbi Berg, are you saying then that both in the Kabbalistic point of view and in that point of view in reference to other commentary, and specifically Barakot 17a and Seder Eliyahu Rabbah, that there is no world to come, there is no something beyond the point of death wherein man and those who have followed the Noachian precepts have something to look forward to in some other physical earthly realm? Are you saying that indeed that once men die, whether they achieve that consciousness or not, there is nothing else? Or are you saying absolutely yes or absolutely no?
No, I didn't imply that at all. What I meant to say, the term hereafter, that is used in the mainstream of religion generally refers to only a hereafter. Now, there is a place within our universe that after death, the soul awaits its either return to be incarnated for a second time or a third time or for the 1,000th time, or it just remains until the time of resurrection, the time then when all souls will meet its former corporeal body. But this time, rather than the corporeal body having dominion over the soul with its desire to receive for oneself alone that greed and corruption which is the energy intelligence of the body, the soul will rule. So there is both Olam Haba and the world where souls reside until such time as they either return for incarnation purposes or at the time of resurrection.
So, Rabbi, then you have answered my question. The answer is yes. But you do agree then that there is a resurrection for us as Jews. I'm talking about totally separate from the Christian point of view or any other. But from our point of view, there is a resurrection, and indeed, there is some, whatever that may be, there is some world. Well, anyway, let's get to my second question very quickly. I know other callers are waiting. In regard to the uses of the names of God in Kabbalah and those references to, and in Zohar, rather, to actual creation, I think in one instance, and I don't have the reference, one rabbi created a cup or something on the table as they were discussing this, as they were involved in using the names of God. And in the same way that the priests of the olden days, that the Kohens brought, used these mighty names of God in the temple, and people were just overshadowed by this incredible name. What do you think of that? Do you think there is creation by that process, or is that, in your opinion, just mythic?
Well, I guess when I first became involved in Kabbalah, one of the first questions that I began to ask was the Lord a member of the underground or the underworld? I mean, he assumed so many aliases. There were so many names for God. Now, what was the reason for so many names? You know, there is Elohim, there is the Tetragrammaton, there is, I mean, I can just go on and on and on. Now, what is the reason for so many names of God? And so, from a Kabbalistic point of view, and this concept of God, is he a man or what is it? And so, from a Kabbalistic point of view, the Lord for us means the force. An energy force. An energy force of which its energy intelligence represents one constant and one concept alone, and that is the desire to share. There are different levels of that force. That force that, in my new book to be seen shortly, how creation came about by the letters themselves, the Hebrew letters, in which different levels of consciousness exist in our universe. In other words, we go up a ladder. As each one achieves an altered state of consciousness, he doesn't achieve the ultimate as Moses, who could just by uttering a name, as the Bible says, was the way he smote the Egyptian. It was not through a physical force. It was through a combination of letters. In this case, the Tetragrammaton. Now, Tetragrammaton is a very potent force.
Yes.
That force will be our only protection if that final war of Armageddon ever comes about. That's going to be the only protection for all mankind. That means for Jew and non-Jew alike. So that's what the names are all about. I hope I've answered your question.
Rabbi, it's an excellent answer, and thank you. Bye-bye.
He touches it on page 161 of his book, The Kabbalah Connection, if you want to take a look at it. Charles, thank you very much for your question. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me is Rabbi Philip Berg. Rabbi Philip Berg. About the Kabbalah, that's what we're talking about, and we are talking to Alan. Alan, welcome aboard.
Hi, people, how are you doing?
Doing fine.
Fine.
Dr. Berg made a statement that he felt that moral codes and traditional doctrines were problematic to knowing oneself and higher awareness, and he sort of dropped the bottom line that sharing was the antidote. And I was wondering what the Kabbalah and his perspective or view is on human sexuality. Is it merely a thing of sharing, or is there some moral consideration, say, in regard to premarital sex, for example?
You can put on your Dr. Tony Grant hat.
I've always raised the question, you know, people get married and they have children, and we know that certainly in 20th century, it's quite a problem bringing up children. Yet we still go ahead, and people have children now, knowing that there's going to be a lot of problems that follow in having children, and just why do people have children? From a rationalistic point of view, doesn't seem logical at all. And so,
I've often thought that. And four of them. Wasn't anything rational about that at all.
Right. And yet, that's the way civilization continues. So there must be another driving force, questions the Kabbalah, that somehow, from a cosmic energy intelligence, something enters into most people who do have children, and somehow direct them into having children. For what purpose? Why does this cosmic energy intelligence exist in the first place? The only answer that is found in the Kabbalah is for the purpose of what we call tikkun, or in other spiritual teachings, karmic purposes, and so forth. The purpose of having children, whether we're aware of it or not, is to provide the soul another opportunity. If there was an offense committed by the soul in a prior incarnation, another opportunity to correct the tikkun process, to correct a prior offense. And without a corporeal body, whose energy intelligence is the desire to receive for oneself alone, that's where all negativity in the world arises from, is to provide the soul with free choice, in other words, do good or do bad. And so that is fundamentally the principal reason for having children, whether we're aware of it or not. But in any event, this is the Kabbalistic interpretation. Now, getting into the premarital sex and otherwise, I think I'd probably have to request from you, Bill, let's say, a couple of more weekly Saturday nights, let's say, for the next 4 years, in getting into that subject. But I'm happy to say that will be a second forthcoming book, Our Reincarnation, which we'll be discussing that particular subject. However, I think we're forgetting one basic idea. Francis Crick, who brought us DNA and then tried bringing us transpermia, in an endeavor to understand the sperm. From a Kabbalist point of view, that sperm is the most potent energy force that exists and is known to mankind. It is used in sex. But I think there is a lack of an awareness of what the individual might be creating, whether on a physical level or a metaphysical level. And the metaphysical level is certainly, for those of you listening to this program, reality. There is an energy intelligence that produces an individual. And no one really even knows how, why, what, and when. But that sperm has the capacity to produce an intelligent human being. There must be an awful lot of power in that sperm. And I think anything with power should be regulated by the individual. and some of the laws surrounding the use of that sperm, the laws that we may be unfamiliar, and nevertheless ignorance of the law is no excuse. And so we in our mind within ourselves can inflict a great deal of damage on ourselves and possibly even on our offspring. But the only thing I can tell you at this point is that we're dealing with a high intelligent, energy intelligent force, and I think whatever surrounds the aspect of sex must be treated carefully.
Do you feel then that, are you saying then that it would be more probable to reach an open mind and cosmic consciousness through abstinence, or does it depend solely on the individual? Maybe if he were more, say, involved intimately, he may reach it. Or can you give some sort of statement?
No, I said that when you have atomic power, you've got to realize the responsibility when you make use of it. Should one abstain from peaceful use of atomic power? Well, that's questionable because we don't even know the results of nuclear power, even for peaceful means. So, when you're talking about this kind of energy intelligence, I would strongly urge, as I do people who are planning on getting married, as I do in my book, you're dealing with energy intelligences of two individuals, and I think you both better get to know each other on another level rather than just with our 5 or 10%. That's really what I'm saying.
So this is clearly a case where you would qualify sharing.
Sharing's gone a long way to achieve a greater awareness, certainly, and I think... That's a step in the right direction.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, Alan. Thank you for the question there. It's 28 minutes past the 10 o'clock mark on Open Mind tonight, and we have opened our minds to the Kabbalah. And with us is Rabbi Philip Berg. I'm Bill Jenkins. I'm up to see him in person. You mind if I go over this this list with everybody? 4 seminars this coming week at the Stephen S. Wise Temple out in Bel Air. Our good friends over there on Monday and Tuesday, August 5th and 6th. The topic will be the power of the alphabet. That's the Hebrew alphabet. Did I say
that's
it
right? You did.
For a Texan and doing it right. On Wednesday and Thursday, August 7th and 8th, Dr. Berg will discuss reincarnation, one of our favorite topics, and certainly suggest you get over and catch that. For further information, you can call the Research Center of Kabbalah in Los Angeles. The number here is in the 213 area code 274-5301. Or 552-9884, or you can contact the station here, broadcast information, and Lita will have all of this information in case you didn't get it here, and we'll touch it again a couple of times before the evening is done. All right, Alan, you're on.
Oh, hello, Dr. Berg, Bill.
Hi.
The first caller happened to remind me of a text I picked up a number of years ago that was a translation of a French manuscript from, I think, the 16th century. And it was called Abramelin the Mage. Are you at all familiar?
I've heard... No, I'm not familiar with the text itself.
Okay. That was just a side issue. Anyway, I was wondering, in the Kabbalah, what's the nature of the self and God and their relation to each other?
Simply stated, I can quote the sages, and I think they kind of wraps up the understanding of the self and God by simply they feel that man is a part of God. Now, when you say a part of God, and I think I touched on that before, and we're not referring to an individual, we're referring to that within each and every single one of us there is a part of that force that is all-encompassing, where past, present, and future is all in one in the present. And we're all part of that. The question of making ourselves aware of this inner self, that part which the corporeal body has no dominion over. I think that's our objective, and that so we're the self and God is really one.
Okay, is there any dimension to God that goes beyond that self?
The force includes all peoples of this earth. In other words, when I said we're part, that implies that every single individual, all of humankind, and sometimes even the lower kingdoms of the inanimate vegetation and animal, all can encompass through the process of the tikkun process, the reincarnation process. We might even find some happy individuals residing there for a short while. And it's all part of the all-embracing unified whole called the Force.
Okay, so it's not like God is a separate person or anything of that nature.
No, a person is not a correct word from a Kabbalistic point of view.
Okay, in what way?
We just couldn't picture a person, because for us a person is someone very finite, and when we discuss the self, we've even gone out of the bounds of the finite of the corporeal body. When we speak of the self, we're talking about something metaphysical. Now we've got to transcend that up to the all-embracing unified whole called the Force of the Lord, that energy force of the Lord. We have no comprehension what the Lord himself is about.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I've heard him referred to as just a core of pure loving energy that seems to solve a lot of,
that is,
a lot of questions.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Well, you mentioned that soul, I guess. I take it you think of actually an entity as far as the soul, that constitutes an entity of some sort.
Yes.
Okay, you mentioned that the soul takes up, can either be reincarnated or take up residence until this end process or end phenomena that you mentioned. I have two questions on that. What determines whether a soul is going to be, what or who determines whether a soul is going to be reincarnated or not? And what is the experience of the soul that's not reincarnated?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow your second question.
Okay, well, we know what our experiences are as human beings.
It's on another plane, on another level. I think I answered that question before about what happens with those souls that have no need for another incarnation. But getting back to your first question, just what determines the shape and form of the incarnated soul is the prior lifetime cassette, as I'd like to call it, of the actions of this individual in a prior lifetime that will govern and direct the, again, a replay. Everything happens again, all over again, giving the individual or that soul another opportunity to correct that which he didn't in a prior lifetime.
Well, as I'm understanding, his question is who makes the determination when he's going to reincarnate? Is that pretty much an individual responsibility?
This is going to sound very strange, but we're touching on another subject. Why do some souls wind up with one set of parents, and some souls wind up in a mansion with luxury, and the other one in a deprived neighborhood and with no chance of advancement? Who determined that? The Lord? That would be an unfair situation. Certainly smells of inequality. And consequently, getting into who determines that, I, without getting into the details, it's the parents who provide at the time of intercourse and conception determine which soul is going to reside with them. In other words, two people who might even hate each other, but you know, sex is a very strange phenomenon. And while they couldn't stand each other's guts, nevertheless, they can still decide on having sex that evening. But the fact that their energy intelligence is of a nature and quality of extreme negativity, they then, and as a result of that, of the intercourse, conception ensued, the conception prepares a vessel that is capable of handling this extreme negativity, and consequently you have a child who is negative. But that child is negative because there is a soul that needs that kind of, that particular vessel of negativity to fulfill is what we call the tikkun process, the correction process. So you see that so much is not within the realm of the Lord. So much is really free choice, but maybe you've got to know the rules and regulations. But it all winds up to our own doing.
Okay, well that's not so far off from what I think.
Want to make it quick, Alan? We got a buzz.
Okay, one last one. What's the technology of the Kabbalah? How do you achieve this loss of self-grasping that you seem to talk about, or selfishness, and actually improve yourself?
I think the first step is recognizing our own limitations and recognizing that two opinions are both correct at all times. And once we recognize that everyone else's opinion is as correct as mine is, because in Ecclesiastes we're told that, chapter 7, that God created one against the other. In other words, and Heisenberg, I guess, with his uncertainty principle established that principle, that everything is real and everything is unreal. Who is right and who is wrong? If the way you see things as reality is reality, and if someone sees it in just an opposite perspective, that's reality too. So we're all right and we're all wrong. And once we begin to recognize the finite of ourselves, I think we're really heading towards a road of understanding our fellow neighbor.
Okay, Alan, does that help you?
Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you for the questions. And thank you for the answers there. They were fine. I'm Bill Jenkins. Tonight we're talking about the Kabbalah. And with me is Rabbi Philip Berg of, on the line. Hello.
Hello?
Yes?
Hi, this is
Rabbi Kravitz?
Yes, it is.
How are you, Rabbi?
Good evening. How are you?
It's good to have you aboard.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask a question, a clarification, on the last explanation that Rabbi Berg gave about who determines how a person's reincarnated.
Mm-hmm.
It was my understanding, in specifically in reading a book, a Kabbalistic book, a Hasidic philosophy book called Tanya, that it's really God that determines where a person is reincarnated, and the concept of the relationship of the parent, the physical relationship determining having some effect on the soul, has to do with the spiritual garments that the person is invested in, of thought, speech, and action, Machshava, Dibur, Ma'aseh, and not that they determine which soul is born into which body. So that seemed pretty different than what I had been learning in the Kabbalah.
Thank you for your question, Rabbi. As we know that there are 70 different faces to the understanding of the Torah, the Bible, I have simply quoted, without quoting my source reference, but the Rabbi Isaac Luria in his Gates of Reincarnation, I believe it's chapter 27, Perek Kaf Zayin. I think it's page 92. I'm not familiar, but I'd be more than happy to refer the source reference, the direct source reference. That which I mentioned previously to one of the callers is exactly as stated by Rabbi Isaac Luria. There are different understandings. There was two giants in Talmudical literature. Tanaim, one said permitted, and the other one said it was not permitted. And from a Kabbalistic point of view, we know they're both correct. Zevzeh elu divrei Elokim chayim. If you understand the phrase, they're both correct. And if we, on our terrestrial level, if we can understand that all of us, with our strict opinions and thoroughly knowledgeable, all of us are thoroughly knowledgeable, Nevertheless, the other person's opinion is also correct, as diametrically opposed as it might be. Consequently, there are different viewpoints, and they're all correct. However, we understand that they're all correct. But what I did quote you was straight from Rabbi Zacharias, Case of Reincarnation.
It just seems a tremendous limitation on God to say that he is not involved in the determination of whether a person, as you said, is born into a family of wealthy people or a family of very poor people. I mean, it seems that everything comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, from God, and it would seem a tremendous limitation. You kind of hesitated when you said that, and it seems that all Kabbalistic literature and Hasidic literature really puts, you know, everything in God's hand except Kabbalah Shemayim and Chutz L'Yerushalayim. Everything is God's hand except the fear of God. And it just seems so different than...
It's not different at all. The statement you just quoted in Hebrew is something I am completely in accord with. Then we'd probably be spending, the next couple of Saturday night sessions on Bechira v'Yediyah. In other words, if God knows all, then where is our free will and choice? And is it all determined? So the fellow says who murders, look, God knew in advance I was going to murder. You know, we'd have to get into that kind of a discussion. From a Kabbalistic point of view, I'm happy to say, and in my, again, in my forthcoming book, Reincarnation, I'm going to present the idea of the way I received it from my teacher, and that it is not contradictory. God knows it all. But then again, if he knows it all, then is he involved? Well, he's involved. Yes, of course he's involved. He is the, what we say in Hebrew, the mapik. He's the producer of the show. He is the one who is going to place that soul. I mean, who's going to place the soul with those particular parents who are building the kind of body that will be the proper receptacle for the soul? I mean, that the parent does not do. I mean, that soul enters by means of the producer being the Lord. So he's involved very much so. But in determination, which was the question, that is left to man. We do have a certain, we do exert a certain amount of free will.
So you're holding that way?
Yeah. No, that's not my opinion. I'm merely quoting, in fact, all my books, I'm happy to say, is none of my material. It's everything that I've learned, and I quote in all my books, the source references. So it's not my opinion. I may have misinterpreted what was written, and I would have to agree with you. But nevertheless, this is the way I read Rabbi Isaac Luria's interpretation of determinism in the rebirth, reincarnation of the soul.
Okay. Thank you very much for clarifying that.
Well, thank you for joining us here, Rabbi.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have... is that Pierre Luigi? I'm trying to get you in. Here we are. You with us now, Pierre Luigi?
Yes.
The button didn't want to stick. But
okay.
Now we've got you.
First of all, let me congratulate you for your show. I think it's wonderful. I've been waiting for almost 2 hours to talk to you, and I think it's been worth every single second. I do have a few questions. I've been hearing a lot about your program, but nobody has touched it. The subject of Atlantis, or the subject of, actually at the beginning of the show you were talking about astronauts about 2,000 years ago. It seems that the most important questions in the show is about reincarnation. So I'll start with the version, excuse me, with a question about reincarnation. Let me put it this way. The population of the world is growing every day. 2,000 years ago there wasn't as much population as there is today. And, of course, it seems that nowadays we have more bodies here than there were souls to start with. So how do you explain that?
And they're all on the San Diego freeway.
Excuse me.
Just throwing in a little levity here, Luigi. The question being, we have so many more living human beings now than we had, say, 5,000 years ago.
That's right. In other words, it seems that there are more bodies now than there were souls to start with.
Where does the spiritual intelligences, where the souls come from?
That's right.
Okay.
Just how many souls are there?
Well, that's what I expect you to...
Well, from a Kabbalistic point of view, one soul... one soul can be divided into an infinite number of levels of consciousness, and they will all be classified as an individual soul, although they may be part of one whole soul. But getting to your question of there appears to be so many more people around, Rabbi Isaac Lurie, in his Gates of Reincarnation, touches on that subject and says, since we have entered the age of Aquarius, and we're going to have to speed up the process. There isn't that much time left. In fact, from a Talmudical point of view and both from a Kabbalistic point of view, the approaching of the 6,000 years, and that leaves us just with about 55 years. And all those souls who have to come back are going to have to come back in a very limited number of years.
What's going to happen in 255 years from now?
Either that ball of fire comes down, if we can't do the job, or we're all going to do it. But we're living in the age of enlightenment, and that's certainly a plus on our side.
Excuse me, in the age of what? I come from a different context. There are some words in English that I still don't understand. I'm sorry.
No, what I'm saying is that the process has to be speeded up, and consequently, so many souls that are in the wings on the stage of history waiting to return for a correction purpose requires a larger number of corporeal bodies to handle these infinite amount of souls. And since there is a limited time left by which they can make their appearance, we therefore experience so many more people coming into existence, more than ever before.
Okay. That doesn't mean that the souls weren't always out there, here, Lindsay, waiting for an opportunity to get into physical life. They may have had to wait a long time because there just weren't that many little opportunities, but they're growing for them now.
In this case, where did these souls come from? How did they originate? Was it a creation of God? Where are they waiting now?
Well, that question was asked before. Where there is a place, a metaphysical area, remember, when we speak of souls, we're speaking of energy intelligences, not in the... in that same frame of reference as a corporeal body.
I'm well aware of that.
And so they're around. They're right next to us. The fact that we don't see them. In fact, there is an expression in the Zohar that if we all suddenly achieved a total awareness of what was around us, we would die of fright. It would just be too much to handle at one time. So there's enough space there for energy intelligences, and they don't, you know, the atom doesn't occupy too much space. And if you're going into the subatomic area, it even occupies less space.
That's right.
I'm always fascinated by the astral travelers who do move over into that realm for a while and have some amazing things to tell you about what's happening on the other side. And it's frightening to them sometimes. And sometimes not.
Okay, well, I'm still not having my mind completely clear about depression, about the answer you're giving me about depression, but... let's move into a different topic. At the beginning of the show, I heard you were talking about astronauts about 2,000 years ago. Can you tell me a little bit more about it? I didn't hear the whole conversation. I was distracted for a minute. By the time I got back to the phone, I heard you were talking about astronauts. Can you tell me more about it, please?
Well, something very close to home. And I know which might come to... as a shock to most of your listeners, Bill. But the Hebrew New Year seems to have found its niche in a certain religious expression, New Year, and even doing repentance and so on. But there was another aspect of Rosh Hashanah called the Shofar.
You want to hold on to that aspect because we have another one that came up here. It's called the news at 11 o'clock.
Okay.
And dear Lizzie, would you want to stay with us?
Yes.
We'll take a break and pause for news and then back with hour 3 of Dr. Philip Berg. the author of The Kabbalah Connection, and we're connecting you with it tonight. You're invited to stay with us this next hour and join on in. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind.
Happy Celebration 25!
It's hour three of Open Mind tonight. Come on in. We've had a stimulating conversation, one that makes you kind of think a little bit. And it all got started when I picked up a book called The Kabbalah Connection by Dr. Philip S. Berg. And I was saying, this guy's been listening to the Open Mind show because so much of what is in there is some of the things that we have learned along the way these last 6 years, you and I, as we have these seminars we call Open Mind. And I'm so very delighted to have Dr. Berg in studio with us. We're talking about the Kabbalah. We were talking to Pierre Luigi. And you're back on.
Okay.
I know we're getting back to kind of space travel.
Indeed.
The shofar, that's the ram's horn, which is used on Rosh Hashanah. That is for the Jewish New Year. From a Kabbalistic point of view, is the origination or the origin of what we today refer to as Star Wars. While at the present time we're still involved with physical technology in creating a physical device for the benefit of a particular country. But the real Star Wars, takes place on this level, right where we are. And it all is linked up and bound up with man's own activity. And the shofar is an instrument that encompasses the entire space program, possibly from an abstruse angle. But nevertheless, the Zohar in Leviticus, the beginning of Leviticus, has a treatise on the aspect of energy travel from this universe into outer space, without getting into details. So, the Rosh Hashanah, as a classic example from a Kabbalistic point of view, encapsulates all of the knowledge that is involved in the Star Wars program, but on a much much more sensitive and I might say more powerful level than we can even dream of. The Bible also makes reference to the gravesite of Moses, that there was no gravesite from the point of view of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Moses did not die, and neither did Elijah the prophet. And the description, the biblical description of his ascending towards the heavens, clearly demonstrates the use of spacecraft. In his elevation to the terrestrial level, extraterrestrial level.
Okay, in your study of how he ascended to the sky, what kind of vehicle did he use? Was it a rocket? Was it something that was moving due to anti-gravitational forces? Or what can you tell me about it? Did you get to find out, or where did he go?
Well, kind of hard to answer that question.
What he's thinking.
I'm sorry I come up with such hard questions.
No, well,
that's okay.
I'd have to use some kind of terminology and then get into the clarification of this terminology. But the Zohar makes use of a word called Metatron, Metatron angel. All angels are actually spacecrafts. In what we pray, our prayers have no ability to touch and experience time travel, meaning reverting back into time. And incidentally, the grandfather paradox, which kind of stymied Einstein, is explicable. There's no problem. He might have had a problem with it, but from a capitalistic point of view, there is no problem. We can return in time, and the way that is done is by making use of these angels, referred to angels, I guess, for the lack of a better word. But they're not angels with, they are angels with wings. Even that concept, like, where did that come from? Why does an angel have to have wings? Because it is a kind of spacecraft which, with proper meditation, Kabbalistic meditation, we can connect with these particular spacecraft vehicles called angels, and they in turn, from a Kabbalistic point of view, and if you like to refer to the Zohar, you might refer to Exodus in the portion of the week called V-E-Y-A-K-H-E-L, V-E-Y-A-K-H-E-L. And there's a kind of some information on how we can make use of these various spacecrafts for particular purposes. You can't use the same spacecraft for every destination.
Historically speaking, when did mankind first had an encounter with a spacecraft?
Adam.
Adam, right?
Adam?
Adam.
Yeah.
That's where it started.
Adam and Eve, are you talking about them?
That's correct.
You mean he came here in a spacecraft?
Well, we're getting there. We're now discussing physical spacecrafts. We don't understand yet that we can, according to Rabbi Isaac Lurie and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, we're on the threshold of human being flying without the necessity of mechanical devices.
I know some who do that quite often.
I believe in that.
Where are you flying to, huh?
I get accused of doing that from time to time.
Okay, I have a couple more questions. I know that there are some other people waiting on the line. Coming back to the reincarnation subject, and let's view into space now. We have such a huge universe, which is actually limitless. It doesn't have an end. There are so many stars and solar systems and other planets where life would be possible. Do we have to reincarnate here on Earth, or can we reincarnate somewhere else within the universe?
We can reincarnate anywhere in the, shall I say, 254 universes. Don't ask me how I know it, but I'd have to ask my friend Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who lived some 2,000 years ago, and maybe he can give me an explanation how he arrived at 254, but that's what he says. But for the tikkun process, for an incarnation, to finally achieve the ultimate correction, there is only one place for that, and that's right here, on planet Earth.
All right, Luigi, did that help you?
Not exactly. I'm sorry, I got a little bit lost again.
Well, I'm going to have to go on because we've been with you a long time.
Okay,
and some of the other ones. And I appreciate your questions.
Okay, Bill, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's open mind.
I'm glad that the focus of the forum is getting into this extraterrestrial aspect, and the focus has shifted this way. I'd like to ask a question, but prefer to preface that question with a explanation of how I came to want to ask this question. In my youth, I had an encounter, a so-called close encounter number 3, at age 13 years. These were beings definitely more advanced than I, but there was a kinship felt, like they might know me from the past or would know me in the future. There was considerable psychic fallout ever after that. And approximately 10 years ago, I looked up in the Encyclopedia Judaica about Kabbalistic tradition. Prior to the time it was written in the oral history, there were several sects of Kabbalists who would pass this word and these words of power onto their own members on as an oral tradition only, certainly more than 3,800 years ago. One of the sect's names translated as "We Who Descend to the Chariots." And that name and the meaning of it has always been eluding all of the so-called experts in the Kabbalistic and the Judaic history. My question, Rabbi Berg, is could it be that it was mistranslated as "we who ascend to the chariots"? Because certainly I don't believe they were talking about chariots with wheels and so forth at that time.
When I was referring to the first document, written document on the mysteries of the Kabbalah and its explanation of terrestrial and extraterrestrial knowledge, I was referring to a written document some 3,800 years ago, authored by Abraham the prophet, called the Sefer Yetzirah, Book of Formation. However, in the Book of Splendor, the Sefer HaZohar, there is mention of a book that was presented to Adam, including all the information concerning technology, astrology, you name it, it was all there. And that's called the Sefer Toldot Adam. It's a book which we refer to as the book that Adam, and when Adam was driven out from the Garden of Eden, that book became lost. The people of the Tower of Babel were in possession of that book, and therefore this kind of wild technology that the Bible seems to infer was taken from that book. Now, all I can tell you about that book is that it's going to be revealed in whatever form that may have been already revealed, in which technology as we have seen it in the past 50 years will be nothing compared to what we're going to experience in a very short while. There's just going to be a tremendous leap into and enter a completely new era of advancement. And it will not be on debate. Space travel from places that do exist, but are on other levels that, because of our limitations, prevent us from observing these places that presently exist.
Certainly a comment here. Early in the it's written, I would suppose you would call it a history, in the Encyclopedia Judaica, they talk not only of Adam, but of Adam Kadmon, the primordial man, that before coming to the Garden of Eden, he had to have passed a certain number of worlds. Had he been coming to Earth from an extraterrestrial source, the planet Earth would have been the sixth or the seventh planet or physical body that he eventually arrived at and settled upon. That is also alluded to in that writing. So that book would have, and that knowledge would also have to be passed on with him.
That is correct. That is correct. Not only that, but the Hebrew alphabet. We have been up until, let's say, the present era. We're all under the impression that creation started with this universe. But the Zohar makes it very clear, the Book of Splendor, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, that the alphabet was created 2,000 years prior to the creation of this world, just the energy intelligences of letters. So there were worlds before this one. They still exist, but not in the same frame of reference as for most of us who still operate on a five-census level.
Therefore, yes, it could be interpreted as the number of planets approaching the center of our solar system from vast distances out there.
Yes, yes. It's all come together.
Certainly, certainly. It's very obvious.
That very same kind of counting was done by the ancient Sumerians. We were discussing this about 4 weeks ago, you remember, with Zachariah Sitchin. Those poor fellows were really good science fiction writers, or historians, one of the two.
Well, it's very interesting listening to your show, and I'm going to turn this over so someone else can get in their questions. Thank you very much for your reply, Rabbi Berg. Thank you.
All right, Danny, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate that one. They get into all things out there, just my open mind folk. I really enjoy each and every one of them. We'll be back in just a moment with Rabbi.
Hi. I've read the Bible several times, and I'm convinced that the Creator is not only creating, not only commanding each of us individually, but is also commanding the universe. And I just wonder, is there anything in the Kabbalah concerning that? You understand what I'm saying?
I'm not quite sure.
Well, I say commanding us because there are things that we do, such as things we do inadvertently, you know, and mistakes we make that are compelled upon us. That is, we don't intend to do any of that. And this leads me to believe that there are forces that are causing us to do this. And I just wonder, was there anything in the Kabbalah that mentioned these forces that are controlling us? Are you aware of it?
Yeah. Well, this other forthcoming book that one day hopefully we'll see the light of day is called Kabbalistic Astrology. There, from a Kabbalistic point of view, it's considered to be almost universal that for most of us, we live in a robotic cosmic sphere. Most of the actions, or sometimes almost all of man's activity, is controlled. However, man is provided with the information from a Kabbalistic point of view on how he can also control the cosmos. So while there is astral influence, and while we say the stars compel, they do not impel. And the information in, again, this is all of this kind of ability of man to control his own destiny, free will, that aspect must exist, and not we are in effect merely robots in a kind of cosmic scheme. And that's kind of difficult to believe that this was God's intent. And
well, of course, is it true that we were created to do the will of God rather than our own will or the will of our egos?
Well, what do you call the will of God? And what I thought I tried to indicate, that we're talking about an energy intelligence called the desire to share. That's the will of God. And what we have been sent down on this planet Earth, and since our basic energy intelligence is one of a desire to receive for oneself alone, the creative process is one of transforming our own selfish desire to receive for oneself alone, and to create an affinity and a devekut, as it is referred to in Hebrew, create a link with a link up with the all-embracing unified whole called the Lord, with that energy force called the desire to share. So this is, when we're told to do the will of God, when there is no such thing as commanding us to do it. In order to receive, you got to share. That's one of the basic principles of Kabbalah.
I see. Well, I was just thinking about all the negativity that's going on in the world. Do you think the Creator is commanding all of that too?
No, that's a self-made man. That's man, because the Creator himself has no connection with the desire to receive for oneself alone, as I think I fully explained in the book Kabbalah for the Layman.
Was it the creator that commanded the flood during Noah's time, or was it man?
Man-made. Everything, every holocaust, every disorder in the universe, all of those beautiful Belarus in heaven, as my next, the immediate book, Kabbalah for the Layman 2, indicates from a Kabbalistic point of view, there isn't a single action in this entire universe, both terrestrial and celestial, that has not been determined by man's activity.
I see. You mean, in other words, man is the only one that can correct the problem?
That is correct.
It usually makes the problem.
I see. So, in other words, man can cure all these cancers and everything, if he desires to do so.
Why not?
But he doesn't seem to know how. He doesn't even know he created it, doesn't he?
He'll always put the illness on somebody else.
I see. Well, it looks like the problem will continue as long as he doesn't know that he did it. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, you know, whenever there's a problem, we always put it overseas. Like we've got the problem with the bees now. That's the African bees, right? Or the Asian flu. Yeah, we're going to have to start getting home because this is where the problem really lies, doesn't it? Okay, we have Sue on the line. Hello, Sue.
Hello, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how much I'm enjoying the show.
Well, thank you.
I want to say one thing, Dr. Berg. I really appreciate the time you're taking to respond. You're reflective and thoughtful in your responses. So often people, when they're on shows, feel they must answer immediately, and you are giving thought to the questions posed, and I think that's really wonderful. I also think there seems to be with the callers this thing of continuing to separate man from God as a person. And until we come to the realization that we are all part of God, each of us, then the negativity will continue. But I think there's a tremendous fear on mankind of taking responsibility for ourselves. And I think many institutionalized religions have perpetrated that for their own purposes, I assume, but we all are a part of God, and therefore each is responsible for whatever is happening on any time, at any place. What I wanted to get into with you was about reincarnation. One thing, my son is adopted. He's not young now, he's in his 20s. And I have always felt, my husband and I were very involved and studied metaphysics, but we had always felt that he could not come into our lives through my body and had to choose his own way of entry, but that he was very much meant to be a part of our lives, and that was the only way he could do it. He had an experience when he was about 4 years old of remembering an incident in another life. And it was just very brief. He had no recollection of it later years. He didn't recall it at all. I'm talking a lot, but I wanted to share something with you. My husband died last year, and he died of cancer. It wasn't a long illness. It came quite suddenly. But I was with him in our home, as we had talked about and he wanted to be when he died. And there was no doubt in my mind, when he made the transition out of the body, I was holding him, talking to him, and talking to the other side, asking them to make it easy for him and to be there for him. And my final, I could feel his life forces moving. But my final words were, and I didn't know where this came from because I don't usually speak in these words, but I said, "Father, accept thy son." And he was gone. I mean, his energy left immediately. Since his death, I've had two encounters with him in an astral, an out-of-body experience, completely uncontrolled. The first time was very brief, and it was a few months after he had died. And he looked about as he did
I just coughed. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Okay. It was just a brief encounter. He looked very much as he did over the year or so before he died. And it was like a reassuring, me. And I was out of my body, and he was out. He was in another, on another plane. Now, the other encounter was just a few months ago. It was of greater length, and we carried on a conversation for I don't know how long, because there's no time in that space. But I said, you know, I was asking, we talked about many things, but I said, why can't we do this more often? I can't seem to have any control over it. And he responded to me, and he said, this is not easy for me to do. And he said, and I have, with a smile on his face, he said, I have many things to take care of. And I asked him if it was good where he is, and if he was happy. And he said, both. And I said, what's it like? And then I said, no, I don't want to ask you that. And he just looked at me and reflected. He looked past me, actually, like he was thinking. And he said, all I can tell you is don't ever harm or kill anyone. Now, my husband has never killed anyone that I'm, not in this life, but we had together. But I think it was an awareness that he had that he wanted to share with me. And at that point, he faded away. And then I went into my body and I awakened. But I just want to say that there is life ongoing. It does not end here. There is so much more out there. And if we can all just become aware of that, and that the world will be what we make it and as we want it to be. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Sue, for those thoughts.
All right. Bye-bye.
Sharing that with us. What an experience that must be to go through. Okay, we have Simon on the line. Simon, you there?
Hello.
Yes.
Can I speak to the rabbi?
He's right here.
Rabbi?
Right on.
My father was a rabbi, and his father was a rabbi. He ran away from Turks during the First World War, and he landed in Burma where I was born. He was a very, very deep student of the Kabbalah. And it's funny, when I was young, people from all over the neighborhood used to bring kids that were raving mad. And he just touches them, and he says a few words quietly in meditation, and he says these words, Sham Fahad Ufahad Lohaya Fahad. And all of a sudden, they change, they become normal again. I don't understand that. And when I was born, he named me Shimon Bar Yochai. And I tell you who I am in case you want to talk to me. I own the Beverly Hills Liquor Castle in Beverly Hills. And it so happens, even my own brother became a rabbi. So when I was coming to the United States, I begged of him to come with me. He said, no, I know a country is going to be born and it's going to be called Israel. And my destiny is to go back there, where I came from.
Do you have a question now for Rabbi Berg?
Is it a fact that people can have healing powers like that from the Kabbalah?
Well, I guess this is a little wild at what I'm going to tell you right now.
This is the show for it.
Or so I'm going to take the liberty.
Okay.
You know, if we thought for a moment about our nails and our hair. We cut nails, we cut hair. And yet they continue to grow. And Rabbi Isaac Luria, in his Shah Ruach HaKodesh, which means the Holy Spirit, I wouldn't like that as an interpretation, but let's say the achievement of an altered state of consciousness, incidentally, which he discusses the aspect of AIDS, asks this kind of question. If someone loses a limb, why doesn't it grow back? And his answer was, it should. You see, with the knowledge of DNA today, the capacity of the root, the DNA itself, has all of the abilities to create the individual in the first place? Why can that source of energy not reproduce an arm or another limb or an infected area or a cancerous area? And his answer to that question is that the world in the age of Aquarius will receive the information on how that power to heal will be part of everyone's household. But for the time being, it was left for the select few. And for those who seem to be the proper channels of energy, then that doesn't mean someone who has earned the right to act as a channel. Because of many aspects of reincarnation, one individual, and like Einstein, he didn't reveal anything that did not exist. But why him and not someone else? And the answer was, his brain was the same as everyone else's. There was nothing within Einstein that appeared to be different, and in fact, there wasn't anything that was different. He was chosen, I can't get into the details, but we even know why he was chosen, to act as this robotic channel. He was purely robotic consciousness, which I can't discuss at the present time. But he was a pure robot, and therefore he was chosen to act as that channel for the revelation of relativity, which already had been mentioned before Einstein by the founder of the Research Center of Kabbalah some 68 years ago when he discussed the theory of relativity. These people are robotic channels for reasons unbeknown to most of us. They are there, and consequently healing powers, people having the ability to heal, is something in a Kabbalistic frame of reference is nothing new and nothing to be marveled.
History is full of them.
That's right.
By the way, my father absolutely refused to take on me, even though we were living in a very pauperish, absolutely, we're eating once in 2 days, and he refused to take any money or gifts when he was doing this thing.
Oh, that's one of the no-nos.
Because he said, if I ever take it, that's it.
That would be the end of it. That is correct. That's right. Okay, there it is.
All right, Simone. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. There it is.
I'm Bill Jenkins. Get to open mind. A few minutes. So before we're all gone, I want to touch again where you'll be conducting 4 seminars this coming week at the Stephen S. Wise Temple up in Bel Air. On Monday, Tuesday, that's August 5th and 6th, we'll be talking about the power of the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet. You've touched upon that already this evening. Wednesday and Thursday, on August 7th and 8th, we'll be discussing reincarnation. And if you'd like further information on that, you can call the Research Center of the Kabbalah at 213-274-5301 or at 552-9884. And, of course, we'll have all this on record here with broadcast information. The Research Center of the Kabbalah is offering classes in the Kabbalah, meditation, reincarnation, and other related topics. So that sounds like stuff our open mind folks will want to get into. And the same numbers for information on that. Or you can write the center if you want to at 9200 Olympic Boulevard, Beverly Hills. Their zip is 90212. Or write me, and I'll make sure that they get it, okay? Let's go to Annie on the line. Hello, Annie.
Hi. Rabbi Berg?
I'm with you.
Yes. You said you called angels spaceships. That seems to imply that angels are physical and not spiritual beings. Is that what your implication means?
No, I was referring to metaphysical. You see, the reality of spacecraft is not what we know it as we observe it today. It's such a finite, limited form of space transportation.
Okay, and these other worlds that the Kabbalah talks about, are they on the physical plane or on the spiritual plane?
On pure energy intelligence, because our scientists now are trying to convince us that 1% is corporeal and 99% is atomic or something we don't observe. So we're getting closer to
Atomic is also part of the physical realm, though.
Well, but not the subatomic. When you get finally into where it's pure energy intelligence, that's reality of even the atomic structure. But in any event, I was referring to a purely metaphysical, beyond the realm of the corporeal,
and
not limited to space, time, and motion.
In other words, space does not exist on those levels.
A space as we know it.
And therefore, these would not be spaceships.
well, yes and no.
See, when you say that something is a spaceship, it gives people the idea that angels are flying saucers, and that's not what they are. Angels are messengers of God that are intelligent beings that were created to do His will.
That is correct. The only reason,
And even when they come into this world, they only take a physical appearance, but they do not have any physicality to them.
You're just taking the words out of my mouth. Three angels appeared before Abraham. Angels can even enter a body. So
they only pretended to eat what He gave them.
Right.
They didn't really eat.
But nevertheless, He saw three corporeal bodies. So there you are. Yes or no?
What I'm saying is that they didn't come from a different planet.
They didn't come from planet Earth.
They didn't come from a different planet. They came from a spiritual realm.
That's right. I didn't say they came from another planet. I shouldn't say that. Because the energy intelligence of Saturn or Mars, Sun, they're all energy intelligences, and we have those energy intelligences visiting man right here with their particular astral influence. So they can come in the form of a purely spiritual nature. When I say spiritual, meaning devoid of any corporeality, or they can also become invested within a corporeal body.
When the Kabbalah speaks of the worlds of Atzilus, Briah, Yetzirah, and Asiya, are those physical or spiritual realms?
All metaphysical realms.
They're all spiritual realms.
Yes, yes.
And these angels originate in those realms, in the world of Yetzirah.
Where are we? We're just a thought process. What is the real self other than a thought process?
Who?
Ourselves. The self. The hands have no director, have no direction, or they have no ability to perform other than following the directive of a thought process. What is a thought process if not metaphysical? So right here, within ourselves, without thinking of extraterrestrial intelligences, there is extraterrestrial intelligence right here within the self.
Yes, that's exactly what I was trying to make the point, is that these spiritual realms of Atzilus, Briah, Yetzirah, Asiya are right here.
That's
right.
They're
not somewhere else.
No, I have an intelligent thing I've got to do here.
Different
right
levels
now.
Of consciousness.
Honey, can you wait just a second, because the spirit has moved me to do something here, okay? Be right back. It's away. 3 from the midnight mark. And, Amy, I want you to wrap up your comments here to the rabbi, because we're just about done.
Okay. The point that I wanted to make is that the real trick in the study of Kabbalah is to strip away the allegory of its physicality and understand the deeper concepts stripped of that physicality. The Kabbalah speaks in the language of men, and therefore it has to deal with these concepts in physical type terms. But it's not talking about anything physical. And I don't think that talking about angels as spaceships and the different worlds as different planets and tefillin as phylacteries, as cosmic transmitters and this type of stuff really does a service to the understanding of Kabbalah, because people are at this time in history are having a difficult enough time understanding that God is not physical, and therefore it's very important to
Okay.
Try to come to the core of the concepts rather than using these.
I think we've got your point there, Amy. There's our music, which means that we've got to go, okay? Thank you very much for jumping in there and joining in. And thank you, Philip S. Berg, Rabbi, Doctor, the Kabbalah Connection, for taking time out to join us on Open Mind. You're deep into our kind of stuff.
Thank you very much, Bill, for the opportunity.
We shall do it again. Promise?
Promise.
And it is.